I'm Marty Moscoen. Welcome to Radio Times.
I have put in place a zero-tolerance policy for illegal entry on our southwest border. If you cross the border unlawfully, then we will prosecute you. It's that simple. If you smuggle illegal aliens across our border, then we will prosecute you. If you are smuggling a child, then we will prosecute you. And that child may be separated from you as required by law.
That was Attorney General Jeff Sessions announcing a new immigration policy to deter families trying to cross the U.S.-Mexico border seeking asylum and entry to the country. In a different and not unrelated story, the government department that places unaccompanied minors revealed that they could not account for 1,475 undocumented immigrant children who had been placed with families. Mind you, these are children who crossed the border without a parent or adult with them. We asked Roque Planas to join us, national reporter for the Huffington Post, and has been covering these stories. Roque, nice to have you with us on Radio Times.
Great. Thanks for having me.
Let me separate these two child immigration stories and start with the 1,475 undocumented immigrant children that the Department of Health and Human Services said they could not account for. What is their explanation for this?
Sure. I mean, I think they are sort of two separate stories, and this one has gotten a lot of attention without necessarily being well understood. When an unaccompanied child shows up at the border who is not from Mexico or Canada, they are placed in the custody of the Office of Refugee Resettlement, and then ORR in turn looks for someone to care for them, usually a parent or a family. Right. So when ORR went to make follow-up calls, these were the number of people that they couldn't necessarily account for. Now, that doesn't necessarily mean that they're missing or that they've been handed off to human traffickers or something like that. It means that he hasn't been able to make contact with the sponsors, and many of the sponsors are oftentimes unauthorized immigrants themselves, and given the climate that we have now, it's not entirely surprising that you might have an outcome like this, but it is, you know, obviously it does sure. raise questions about ORR's capacity to keep track of the kids once they're out of their custody.
No, absolutely. Roque, we don't have the greatest line with you. We're going to carry on, but we might at some point call you back just to make sure that our listeners can hear what you're talking about. This is the Office of Refugee Resettlement. Is that under the Department of Health and Human Services?
Yes, that's correct.
And as you indicated, when they went to figure out where these children were, 1,475 were unaccounted for. And I guess on the one hand, you could think, oh, my gosh, you know, they might be in the hands of smugglers. On the other hand, they might just be someone might not have answered a telephone, for instance, and therefore that child is, quote unquote, unaccounted for.
That's correct.
Who are these sponsors, and how does one get to be a sponsor for one of these children who cross the border by themselves or certainly without an adult?
Oftentimes, they're family members who are already living here. Or one of the reasons why you have so many Central American migrants coming in recent years is because throughout the 1970s and the 80s, many people came here from Central America fleeing the civil unrest and civil wars of the time. So many of them have family here already. So the first choice is to hand them off to a parent. And second choice is another family member. And in the worst case scenario, they're going to end up in some kind of sort of foster care situation.
What's the chance that one of these people taking care of these children are undocumented themselves?
Pretty high. I mean, there's certainly... you know, we don't have numbers on that, but certainly some of the people are unauthorized themselves. Other people might have TPS, which the president has recently, well, the Department of Homeland Security has recently canceled for people from El Salvador and Honduras. So it's also likely that someone might have work authorization, but a very tenuous ability to remain in the country.
Who is responsible then for these children that have been placed?
Well, I mean, ultimately... the sponsors now, but it looks like because of the pressure that's been generated, ORR is going to keep trying to reach them.
Let me talk about the other story. We played a clip from Attorney General Jeff Sessions talking about this new zero tolerance policy. I thought it was interesting and perhaps illuminating that he talked about children being smuggled across the border. Is he talking about parents smuggling their children across the border?
Well, this is something that we see with the Trump administration quite a bit. They want to inflate or conflate regular migrants, many of whom come here seeking asylum, with criminals, right? And that's part of what Jeff Sessions is doing here. There is no doubt that some people cross in the hands of traffickers, but what the policy is actually doing is making it so that a mother who comes across the border with their child, or even in some cases through a legal port of entry, can then be separated from the child as a means of deterrence. And the way that Jeff Sessions is doing that is by making a blanket policy of referring everyone who crosses illegally for criminal prosecution. That is a very new sort of way of approaching this problem.
Well, how new is that, and how different is that, let's say, from the Obama administration or even the second Bush administration?
So all of this goes back to the second Bush administration. So just I think it's really important for your listeners to understand we have two sort of immigration systems. We have a criminal system. We have a civil system. Most people who get detained or deported are in the civil system. They are going to go before an immigration judge if they have a claim, and that judge is going to adjudicate the claim, and then they will be deported. That's, you know, ICE, Border Patrol, immigrant detention. That's all the civil system. Now, however, since the 1920s, the U.S. government has had the capacity to prosecute people who cross the border illegally. And under U.S. law, the first time you cross, that's a misdemeanor punishable by up to 6 months in jail if you are caught in the act. And if you are caught in the United States in any one of the 94 districts after having been deported in the past, you can be prosecuted for felony reentry with a punishment of up to 20 years in jail, depending on your criminal record. So back in 2003, under the George W. Bush administration, the Department of Homeland Security got together with the Department of Justice and decided they were going to start prosecuting more migrants when they ran out of detention bed space. And they came up with a program called Operation Streamline that funneled a lot of people into criminal courts instead of the civil system. And it has grown since then, peaking at around 90,000 cases, about half the federal criminal docket a few years ago, about 2013, I want to say. Okay, so now what's different here is that people who typically weren't subjected to prosecution before, right, asylum seekers and people crossing with their children, are now being referred for criminal prosecution under this zero tolerance policy that Jeff Sessions has announced. And now, no matter how much they want to say they're going after traffickers and so forth, it's very clear that this is meant as a deterrent to keep families from crossing the border outside ports of entry.
Well, let me quote White House Chief of Staff Kelly, who was interviewed by NPR, talking about this new policy, saying the children will be taken care of, put into foster care or whatever. But then he goes on to say, but the big point is that they elected to come illegally to the United States. And this is a technique that no one hopes will be used exclusively or for very long. Basically, and we heard this from the head of Homeland Security as well, which is that if you are here illegally or as an undocumented person with children, you are a criminal.
Yes, correct. I mean, that is the way that they've gone about sort of spinning this problem. I guess the long-term issue here is that typically people that cross the border outside of ports of entry have still been allowed to make asylum cases. Right. And that's something that you're still allowed to do under U.S. law, even if you get that conviction. For illegal crossing, right? Another trend that we've seen since the beginning of the Trump administration is that CBP is turning away people at the border, declining to allow them to come in and make asylum claims. Now, if that happens to you enough times, and we've certainly spoken to people that's happened to multiple times, sooner or later, you might make the choice to come outside of a port of entry, right? And even when people are coming through legal ports of entry, they are still, in some cases, getting separated from their children. The main legal challenge to this was filed well before the zero tolerance policy, right? Back in February by the ACLU on behalf of a Congolese woman who was separated from her daughter when she crossed through a legal port of entry in Southern California. So I think, you know, I understand that the administration is very committed to reducing the number of illegal crossings. That was Trump's perhaps main campaign promise.
Sure.
But the way that this is structured, right, is all about creating deterrence.
And deterrence, essentially the threat of separating a child from a parent. Is it how unusual to separate a child from a mother?
Very unusual. I mean, that's a very new policy from the Trump administration. And not to say that it didn't happen in isolated cases in the past, but right. to make it a systematic policy, this is new. And I mean, I think takes a sort of unique kind of mindset to make that happen by prosecuting one of the pettiest crimes that you can possibly do under federal law. When someone goes to have their charges heard for illegal entry, more than likely, it's going to be an open and shut case, and they're going to spend time served or 5 to 7 days in jail. Now they're getting shunted to some immigrant detention center, who knows where. Whereas if they had been put up in family detention, as had been previously the case, more than likely they would have had access to lawyers. And now you're introducing the problem that they don't know where their kids are. So, yeah, I mean, it's very new. It's also sort of uniquely harsh.
Absolutely. If the system is to essentially criminalize treat people as criminals coming here undocumented, can our system deal with that numbers of people?
I don't know. There's definitely going to be a capacity question, depending on how many of these cases that Jeff Sessions wants to prosecute. Certainly, he's referring every single person for prosecution, but not every case, because there's just simply not going to be that much room in magistrate court. There's not going to be that many public defenders or court-appointed attorneys, and there's not going to be that much bed space with the U.S. Marshals Service. But it is really important, I think, for everyone to understand, too, that this comes at a cost, right? The year that federal criminal immigration prosecutions started approaching half the docket was 2008. Huh. And if you look at the grand sweep of criminal activity that was going on in the country at that time, right, that was the time that the United States was going through this economic crisis provoked by widespread fraud at all levels of our financial system, right? And only one banker was prosecuted over that, right? In a year where consistently from 2008 until now, immigration prosecutions have taken up half the criminal docket, and they're entirely redundant. Right. Because we already have a similar civil immigration system to deal with them. So there's a question in my mind about what the priorities at the Justice Department are. Right. You can. These people who are crossing the border are criminals, and that might be true under a strict definition of the law, even though the United States has typically accepted asylum seekers who come between ports of entry. But what crimes are not being prosecuted so they can have this myopic focus on misdemeanor illegal entry cases?
Well, Rocky, we're going to end on that note. Rocky Planus, national reporter for the Huffington Post, talking about this new immigration policy, zero tolerance. Rocky Planus, thanks for joining us today in Radio Times.
A pleasure. Thanks for having me.
You're very welcome. We're going to talk more about immigration. In fact, talk about how ICE got started after this very short break. Stay with us. We'll be right back. I'm Marty Moscoen, and you're listening to Radio Times here on WHYY in Philadelphia. We've been talking about a new zero-tolerance immigration policy, prosecuting people, including families, crossing the U.S.-Mexico border, threatening to separate children from their parents as a form of deterrence. And that got us thinking about ICE, Immigration and Customs Enforcement. It was created after September 11th, the terror attacks of that day, and as part of the sprawling Department of Homeland Security, also created after September 11th. Joining us is May Nye, professor of history at Columbia University, to talk about ICE. And May Nye, nice to have you with us on Radio Times.
Thank you for having me. Good morning, Marty.
Good morning. I think a lot of people would be surprised. Frankly, I was when I realized that ICE is just about 15 years old. How and why was it started after September 11th?
Well, ICE is really a continuation of the Border Patrol that dates back to 1925. After Homeland Security Act was passed in 2002, Congress divided the work of the former Border Patrol into ICE on the one hand and the Border Patrol or Customs and Border Protection, CBP, on the other. So the CBP deals with the border and the border area, And ICE deals with the interior of the country, as well as they also do other things. They deal with trafficking, smuggling, et cetera. But mostly it's interior immigration enforcement.
Was there, in its original creation, was the goal to go after immigration, or was it to go after potential terrorists?
No. When the Border Patrol was formed in 1925, it was formed to deter unlawful or unauthorized entry. Before this time, what many people don't understand is we had virtually open borders in the United States. You had a few customs officers on horseback patrolling the border, and they were mostly looking for Chinese who were trying to circumvent the Chinese exclusion laws. But for Europeans, we had basically open borders, and most people also arrived at seaports such as Ellis Island or Philadelphia or Boston. So it was only in 1924 when Congress passed a comprehensive immigration restriction law, which reduced immigration to 15% of what it had been before World War I, that it now thought necessary to patrol the borders, both land and sea borders of the country, in between ports of entry.
This ICE is under the auspices of the Department of Homeland Security. Now, that was also created after September 11th. More than 20 agencies, I used the word sprawling to describe DHS. How do you see this agency?
Well, I think you're exactly right. It's sprawling. It grows all the time. What's interesting about ICE in particular is that it is, for the first time, authorized to pursue both civil and criminal cases. So this has to do with what your former guest was talking about in terms of the criminalization of unlawful entry. But yes, ICE is a sprawling organization. Immigration was formerly handled by Justice and State Department and Justice Department. And the State Department still issues visas for people seeking entry to the United States. But the enforcement arms of DHS are huge.
Well, and I guess I mentioned this earlier, but just to make sure we all understand. So we should think of ICE as a form of counterterrorism?
Well, counterterrorism is one of its mandates. I don't think that is where most of its resources are deployed. Most of its resources are deployed to immigration enforcement. But yes, it is part of its remit to do counterterrorism. And counterterrorism, frankly, the way it's pursued by this government is in large part done as an immigration question. They assume that terrorists are foreigners, when in fact, you know, if you look at Oklahoma City, you look at any number of mass shootings that are done by American-born or American citizens, they're done by whites. That is not really considered as important to this administration as pursuing people who happen to be Muslim or from Arab countries. So that's a whole other story.
It is.
About how counterterrorism is defined. It's defined in large part as an immigration question.
Well, I'm thinking about how the president talks about immigration. Even last night at a rally in Tennessee, making reference to MS-13, the idea that immigrants are threats, are dangerous, are gang members. How do you see that?
Well, MS-13 is definitely a problem, and the gangs in Central America are actually an interesting phenomenon because they are in large part actually created by our immigration enforcement policy. It's an unintended consequence of immigration. Many of these gangs have their origins with young people from countries like El Salvador who are in the United States, who are deported back to El Salvador, where they have no family, they didn't know anybody, they had no prospects for employment or education. And they started to form gangs, which then reached back into the United States. So, if we had actually supported kids in this country to begin with, we may not have the problem to the extent that we do. So, yes, gangs are a problem. MS-13 is a horrible you know, practice of gang violence. But come on, Marty, not all immigrants are gang members.
Sure.
This is really just done to scare people. You know, it's a fraction of the number of immigrants in this country. It's a fraction of the number of people who are here who don't have documents. You know, there are 11 million unauthorized immigrants living in our country. They're not gang members. They're hard workers. They go to work. They work often for less than the minimum wage. They live in fear now that, you know, the administration has declared that it wants to deport anybody and everybody. But so I think this whole hype around MS-13 is really a very political ploy to get the American public to oppose all immigration. And it's just not where the facts are.
Well, and part of the facts is that the crime rate for undocumented immigrants in the United States is less than for native-born Americans, just to underscore
Absolutely. What
you just said there. Let me just quickly reintroduce you. That's May Nye. She's a professor of history at Columbia University. We called her up to help us understand about the evolution of ICE. That's Immigration and Customs Enforcement, created after September 11th, part of the Department of Homeland Security. And we're talking about how that fits into immigration policy and the president's new zero tolerance policy. You can join us at 1-888-477-9499. You can also send us an email, radiotimes@whyy.org. And you can tweet us at WHYY Radio Times. What is the power that ICE has? Now, I'm talking to you from a sanctuary city here in Philadelphia, but generally speaking, if you're an ICE official, what kind of powers do you have?
Well, ICE agents have the power to serve warrants for deportation on people who are, who are found to be or suspected to be unlawfully in the country. They can stop people and ask them for their papers. You know, they are like a police force, but they're federal. They're not local. Mm-hmm. And you mentioned sanctuary. That's a very interesting point. You know, the immigration law has a provision called 287G, which allows ICE to work with local law enforcement, but it's voluntary. And I really want to stress that it's voluntary. Right. No state or local, you know, city or county jurisdiction is obligated to work with the government, to work with ICE. And in fact, the Constitution's 10th Amendment says that the federal government cannot coerce state jurisdictions to enforce federal laws. So sanctuary cities are actually upholding a constitutional right to refrain from enforcing federal laws. So this whole idea that sanctuary cities are breaking the law is actually upside down.
Well, that's really, really interesting, because we know that Jeff Sessions has certainly threatened sanctuary cities, saying that the government would withhold funds for sanctuary cities because of their unwillingness to comply with ICE agents.
Right. They can't do that. The Supreme Court has ruled since the 19th century that they can't do that. But more recently, it ruled in the case of the Brady gun law, for example, the court that law had in its original passage a provision that states do mandatory background checks for people who wanted to buy guns. And the Supreme Court said, using this 10th Amendment, said that the federal government cannot force states to enforce a federal law. And then more recently, with the Affordable Care Act, the so-called Obamacare, the Supreme Court said that the federal government could not force states to take the Medicaid extension. So they had to make that voluntary.
I was talking...
So in very recent decisions, I mean fairly recent, in the last couple decades, the Supreme Court, under its conservative majority, has upheld the 10th Amendment. So I don't think that if the Trump administration tries to say, we're going to take away Philadelphia, we're going to take away your transit money or your health care money or any funds that you use, if you don't help ICE, that's not going to stand up in court.
Let me go back to the zero tolerance policy. We played a clip from Attorney General Jeff Sessions essentially saying that if you are here undocumented, you are basically here as a criminal and could end up in the criminal court system. How different, I asked our first guest this, but from your perspective, how different is this compared to Obama and also to the second Bush administration?
Well, Marty, historically, immigration violations are considered civil offenses. They're dealt with in civil court. They're not criminal matters. There are criminal sanctions on people who repeatedly enter unlawfully. But most immigration cases are considered civil, and they have been pursued in that way. Now, to criminalize people at this point is, I think, aside from it being a massive waste of resources, is just really to up the terror quotient in terms of what they are doing to immigrant communities. You know, we have 11 million undocumented people in this country. 85% of them have been in this country for more than 5 years. They live in cities, as I said earlier, they're workers, they're parents, they're community members, and they suffer from tremendous discrimination and exploitation because of their undocumented status. There is no way that the administration is going to actually deport 11 million people. It's impossible. They don't have, at minimum, they don't have the resources to do that.
And how would you do that?
Well,
just logistically speaking, I mean, how would
Right. You can't. They can't do it. But what they are doing is creating a climate of fear where anybody fears that they could be picked up. So they don't have to go arrest 11 million people. They just have to have 11 million people frightened to death that they will be picked up. And one of the things that the Trump administration did, one of the first things it did, was that it eliminated priorities that the Obama administration had set. Now, those priorities were not even really new under Obama, but he kind of wrote them down as more explicit guidelines. Because they knew, like I think Trump administration knows, you cannot actually make everybody a priority. So the Obama administration had as its first priority so-called dangerous criminal aliens, right? And then it goes down the list from there. So DACA was all about deferred action because these young people were considered probably the lowest priority for deportation, right? And in between, you have a lot of people who are ordinary workers who actually pose no threat to society. So you had a system of priorities. And many people who actually had outstanding orders for deportation were told, look, you know, you're a good guy, you know, or you're a good woman, you know, we're not going to deport you, but just check in with us once a year. And so some people have been doing that for years, for 10, 20 years. Now, the Trump administration is saying there are no priorities. Everybody is a priority. So that means anybody that they pick up, regardless of, you know, what their situation is now put into removal proceedings. So how does this work? Well, one of the main ways it's worked is that when ICE has gone to serve a warrant for deportation, because they have somebody's name, they have a warrant. This is perhaps somebody with a criminal record or whatever. And they go to this person's home and they serve the warrant on the person they're pursuing. They will pick up everybody in that house. A neighbor who might be visiting, a child, you know, like a teenager, they will pick up anybody and process them to see if they are subject for removal. So that's what we would call collateral damage, right? If you just happen to be there when they serve a warrant on somebody else, they're not really supposed to do that. But now that they have this policy of zero tolerance and everybody's a priority, people can just get swept up. They've also reintroduced doing workplace raids, which Obama stopped, right? And so now they're raiding workplaces. And all you have to do is a few of these, and they're sensational, and everybody's frightened to death.
Let me pick up on a couple of things because, I mean, we have just a couple of minutes before we have to say goodbye to you. And as you were describing this, it reminds me of how many times has our Congress tried to come up with some kind of immigration reform, knowing that there are 11 million undocumented immigrants living in this country that, as you say, and I think we can all agree, are not going to get deported. And yet we are left with a policy now that just puts everyone in a fearful mindset.
Absolutely. You know, we used to have a policy in the early 20th century, which was a policy of a statute of limitations on unlawful presence. So if you were here for 5 years and the reason for your deportability is considered moot. So, you know, we have statutes of limitation on all civil and criminal offenses except for a handful. Murder, kidnapping, treason, and crossing the border without a visa. So why can't we say, if you've been here for X number of years, you know, we're gonna forgive that. You know, if you've had a clean record, you contribute to society, you know, we should give people a legal status and a path to citizenship.
You think that's
it? We continue to treat people as criminals, and it's really reprehensible.
We're almost out of time here, but do you think that will ever happen? Are we ever going to resolve this?
Well, you know, there's a very strong immigrant rights movement in this country. It's led by young people, the Dreamers and workers, and they're very powerful. And I think that they have the support of the American people. You know, all the polling shows that the majority of Americans do not support mass deportations. So I think if we get the right people in Congress, you know, they can do the will of the people. Right now, what Congress is doing, what the administration is doing, is not the will of the people.
May Nye, thank you for joining us today in Radio Times, professor of history at Columbia University. And we've got a third guest waiting in the wings. We'll be right back. I'm Marty Moss-Cohen, and you're listening to Radio Times here on WHYY in Philadelphia. We've been talking about a new anti-immigration policy announced by Attorney General Jeff Sessions that prosecutes anyone illegally crossing the U.S. border and separates children from their parents. The parents will be held in federal jails while their children will be sent to shelters run by the Department of Health and Human Services. The Department of HHS said yesterday it had more than 10,000 migrant children in its custody. Senator Kamala Harris questioned the Secretary of Homeland Security, Kirstjen Nielsen, on May 15th about the training for officers taking children away from their parents.
When you are separating children from their parents, do you have a protocol in place about how that should be done? And are you training the people who will actually remove a child from their parent on how to do that in the least traumatic way? I would hope you do. Train on how to do that. And so the question is, and the request has been, to give us the information about how you are training and what the protocols are for separating a child from their parent.
I'm happy to provide you with the training information.
Thank you.
We asked Carola Suarez-Orozco, professor of human development and psychology at UCLA, where she's co-director of the Institute for Immigration, Globalization, and Education. And Carola, nice to have you with us on Radio Times.
Thank you very much, Marty. It's a pleasure to join you.
Thanks so much. What is the answer to that question that Kirstjen Nielsen was unable to answer, which is how are officers or how should people be trained if they're going to take children away from their parents?
Well, I have to begin by saying that there's not a lot of training that can be done that makes this untraumatic. I'm happy to comment as a developmental psychologist, and I will, but I first want to point out that it doesn't take a social scientist to recognize that separating children from parents is really a cruel act, and there are immediate and observable consequences that have far-reaching implications for basic trust, security, and well-being. Human children are attached to their parent figures. They look to them for cues on what to expect, a sense of security, and for them to meet their basic needs. and this is the very most basic of mammalian features, right? The children that we are talking about have already been through a series of traumatic events, including what propelled them out of some of the most violent countries in the world. They went through a very traumatic crossing, the voyage, arduous journeys, and then the dangerous crossing. And now, you know, they're being wrenched away from their families.
Well, let me pick up on a couple of things there. And it does appear as a rather, I'm not sure what the word is, but cavalier attitude towards traumatized children. The head of the White House, Kelly, said, you know, foster care or whatever. It was clear from it was clear from Kirsten Nielsen that she did not have an answer to that important question from the senator. And of course, we're talking about Jeff Sessions, the attorney general, basically saying, if you come here, we're going to treat you like a criminal and we will take your children away from you. Seems unprecedented.
It truly is unprecedented. And, you know, we have lots of evidence that separating children, and here I'll go into the developmental speak, and then I'll, give you some evidence about what we know about separating children from parents. So I will answer that, and then I'll go back to, let's talk about foster care, what we know about foster care, and then let's answer, do civilized societies take children away from parents?
Well,
and I think that that's a really important question.
Sure.
Go ahead.
Please. Yeah, let me just frame it a certain kind of way, because children do get separated from parents in the case of domestic violence or abuse and neglect to protect those children from the adults, be they parents or adults in their lives. But, you know, one would assume that if a family, a mom or a dad, is bringing their child from a war-torn and violent country, that they want something better for their children. Speak to that, if you could.
Well, absolutely. The children coming out of the place. Look, I'm a scholar of immigration. People do not migrate lightly. Most people would rather stay in their own spaces. You know, migration comes out of a desperation is a strong word, but there's a certain amount of that. You leave your country because things are not what they should be. You are pulled or pushed out of the space that you're in. And the people who are coming out of Central America, which is the majority of where the kids we're talking about right now are coming from, are coming out of really desperate situations, and they're, most of these countries are listed amongst the top or the bottom 10 most violent spaces right now. So kids are, and in the past, let me say that most of the pattern has been that the children were left behind, the parents went ahead. So you know, I've done research on family separations, and in most cases, the children were left with grandparents and aunts. The parents would come ahead, and then they would send for the children. So this is kind of a newish pattern that the parents are taking their kids with them. That speaks to how desperate they are in terms of knowing that the spaces are not safe.
Well, let me just pick, and I'm just watching the clock here, and I want to make sure that we cover everything that we need to cover here. But we do hear stories, just heartbreaking stories of children literally being separated from their parents, and they're calling out, you know, mommy, mommy. What is, under these kinds of circumstances, is there a humane way to take a child from a parent?
I don't think there is, honestly. You know, there is, you know, we know that, I mean, I'll give you a couple bits of evidence.
Sure.
You know, the Urban Institute did a study of kids there was a mass deportation about 10 years ago, right under Bush, where when they first started doing raids on in workplaces, and they did a study of the kids whose parents were being deported, and they looked at what happened right after a parent was deported, and then you know, 3 months after and then 9 months after. And and I was part of that study, so I know a little bit about it. And, you know, what they found is that 70% of the kids had, and those kids were staying with at least one parent. Mm. So one parent was deported, the other. So that's a less traumatic situation, right? They were still in their same homes. 70% of those kids were showing at least three symptoms, like lots of crying, disruptions in sleeping, disruptions in eating patterns, 3 months afterwards, and then a third of them 9 months afterwards. So those kids were highly affected. Another study I can quickly draw on is a study of 400 kids that I did with from five different countries. 75% of them had been separated from their parent from anywhere from 6 months to 10 months prior to migrating. That just comes as normative with migration. The kids who had been separated for longer periods of time had much higher levels of much more complicated family reunifications and much higher levels of anxiety and depression.
Well,
so we know it's bad for kids.
And what we're hearing is that some of them are going with sponsors, some of them going with parents or extended family, and some of them ending up in shelters. And I'm just trying to imagine, lots of beds filled with children and what children under these circumstances need.
Exactly. And many of them probably not being taken care of by people who speak the language. So, how are they, are we sure that they're being... Are there Spanish speakers in all those cases? I mean, how are those children being comforted? Who's helping make sense of that situation? What kinds of, under the worst of, if you have to take a child away from a parent, you'd at least help them make sense of it and say, in 3 months from now, this is just temporary. You'll be fine. In 3 months from now, everything will be fine. You'll be back together. This is complete chaos with no sense. No rhyme or reason, no narrative about when things will be better. It's the worst kind of situation.
Let me just read a couple of comments that we have. A tweet from Nathan: separating children from their parents was a practice from the days of slavery, when children were separated from their parents, robbing them of their language, culture, and sense of being. This is a cruel practice and shocking that we are doing it again. An email from Joey: CBP is intentionally inflicting emotional distress upon children for a deterrent effect on their parents. This is simply cruelty from elected officials who don't view the border crossers as fully human.
Human. That's right.
So for these children who are in the system, and we have heard some stories of parents trying to find their children, I'm trying to imagine even the effect on a parent not knowing where their child was.
Can we imagine any more desperate situation? Any of us who are parents or have care for anyone who are parents, can we imagine a more desperate situation? Mm-hmm. Especially when the whole migration was framed around trying to give a better life to these children. I mean, it is a very effective political strategy, but it is barbaric, and it is not something that we should be participating in as a civilized democratic society.
In the best of circumstances, let's at least consider that. What would a child need in order to feel some degree of security and to feel that at some point they will be reunited with their parent? What does a child? What are good, positive, beneficial, supportive services look like?
Well, that's good. That's a good question. Certainly there have to be seekers of the child's language, so that it needs to be as uninstitutional like a space as possible. There have to be regular routines, kind and warm people, some educational, practices going on so that the child is not languishing. Some way for the child to be in verbal contact with the parent. So somebody saying this is what to expect and this is when, you'll be next in contact with There has to be some sort of narrative of what to expect next, and that transitional service of some kind.
Right.
The problem is, I think it's chaos, and I don't think there are plans for what to do with these children.
Because we're talking
what are they
about
planning to do.
But we're talking about big bureaucracies that are trying to manage small children in some cases.
Right. Right.
I'm also thinking about...
There aren't that many, my understanding is there aren't very many facilities and there are at near capacity. And, I don't imagine folks are very well trained in the needs of traumatized children. The sense that I have is that they are treating it almost like prison facilities rather than caretaking facilities, right? It's punitive. The model is punitive. The children are suffering for the sins of their quote-unquote fathers or mothers.
Because essentially the message is that if you're a parent bringing a child into this country, you're a bad parent.
Exactly.
What about reunification for those families that do get back together? That has got to be complicated for a child who has been separated from a parent and not understanding all, immigration policy and all the things that can complicate this. How does that reunification, how can that be made, again, healthy and how can a child be made whole?
Well, again, that takes, my experience, what I've learned with the reunification is it depends on the child. It depends on how long the reunification is. It depends on how the parent handles it. There's often a lot of anger and ambivalence, mm-hmm. And guilt because the child is longing for the parent, but also feels somewhat angry. At the parent for having, caused this to happen. At the same time, they feel guilty for feeling that anger. And all of this doesn't get talked about in many families because, processing is not something that all families are particularly good at. And so that kind of festers as a wound. So, in an ideal situation, you have churches are often great places for those things, spaces for those, groups to get together where guided conversations can happen, where other families that are going through it can see that it's a normal process. It's not just them. And it's a space of trust in many cases, in many families, because institutions, one of the dangers of all of this is that institutional organizations now are no longer trustworthy, right? Institutions have forced these problems onto the families. So, one of the really sad things I have to say is that children want to belong to the new society desperately. And if you give them half a chance, they're going to be the best little citizens you can possibly imagine. And what we're doing here is imposing mm-hmm. this chaos and this lack of sense of belonging disrupting basic trust. And this is one of the things that's falling to the wayside in what we're doing right now.
I hate to end on that note, but we do have to do that. Carola Suarez Orozco, thank you very much for joining us today on Radio Times.
Thank you very much, Marty. Thank you for addressing this important problem.
Absolutely. And she's with UCLA. Go to whyy.org/Radio Times to find out more about the program. Diana Martinez, the engineer for today's edition of Radio Times, the show produced by Debbie Builder, John Ahrens, and Alex Stern. I'm Marty Moscoane. Thank you for joining us.